plans to nuke the world without nuking yourself first. When the government goes to clean up its nuclear messes or cover up evidence, it always tries to make the public focus on the here and now nature of its work. Jobs! Tax base! And not focus on the history of radioactive and chemical contamination at every site that has ever manufactured nuclear weapons. They make it sound like it's an easy, fast, simple job, in and out, and voila, an industrial park results. Not a word about the devastating impact of that site on the soil, water, air, as well as the health of the local community. So when you learn of yet another World War II-era nuclear manufacturing complex that's being demolished, and you hear a genuine expert say,
I think when we ask ourselves as a people, how much of an investment are we being asked to give to this industry, we need to think about its legacy, because some of these properties, they just have to be monitored on into the future forever.
Well, when you hear something like that from someone who has spent more than a year of her life researching a single previously unconsidered nuclear site, you realize that no matter where you live, you are in the radioactive seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with journalist Claire Schaefer Duffy, who wrote a series of three articles for the National Catholic Reporter on the Kansas City plant, the facility that built 85% of all non-nuclear parts for our nuclear bombs. But when is a non-nuclear site not a non-nuclear site? That's what Claire's articles were about. Because even as the facility was known as non-nuclear, radioactive materials were used on site for decades, creating a poisonous legacy that is still being played out. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than ever got out to the public after the atom bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we'll tell you why all that is coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 6, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. First, the acknowledgement that today marks the 74th anniversary of the United States dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. The detonation resulted in the incineration and death of approximately 140,000 human beings. That's an estimate from 1946. A subsequent study in 1998 put the figure at well over 200,000. By including deaths from post-explosion radiation exposure and the illnesses that resulted, we will never know the exact number of deaths caused, but what we do know is that the United States had developed two different kinds of atom bombs and wanted to test both technologies against each other, which is why a second atom bomb, we'd call it a nuclear bomb today, the name change and intentional rebranding, a second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki on August 9, killing an estimated additional 75,000 human beings. The atrocity of these weapons of mass destruction has been covered over, softened, their severity distanced, if not hidden, from subsequent generations. The two bombs remain the two greatest uses of weapons of mass destruction in human history. And now the United States is moving forward to build more so-called usable nuclear weapons. During today's final thought, I will have more on how we, the people, have been manipulated in our nuclear understanding since even before these bombs were dropped on Japan. Moving on to the news. An update on Piketon, Ohio, where in May, local officials abruptly closed a 500-student middle school, Zahn's Corner, with plans to keep it closed when school starts up again in fall, after learning that the U.S. Department of Energy had found the highly dangerous radioactive substance neptunium-237 near the school, and after new independent testing discovered enriched uranium inside the building. The radioactive elements are believed to be sourced from the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant, only 4 miles away, which is in the process of being demolished. Now, the battle is over. Who did their radiological testing the right way? With the Department of Energy and Ohio Department of Health saying, nothing to worry about, no problems here. And Northern Arizona University scientist Michael Ketterer, an independent researcher, questioning the methodology of the federal tests. Meanwhile, a class action lawsuit has been filed on behalf of residents within a 7-mile radius of the Portsmouth plant, naming United States Enrichment Corporation, which oversaw uranium enrichment at the site after 1993, as well as a number of other contractors who have processed recycled radioactive materials there. To be continued. Also in Ohio, the State House of Representatives passed House Bill 6 on Tuesday, July 23rd, to bail out the Davis-Bessey Nuclear Power Station, open beyond its scheduled closure in 2020. The new law would create a new 85-cent charge on monthly electric bills for residential ratepayers, generating up to $150 million a year for First Energy Solutions' two aging, decaying nuclear plants, Davis-Bessey and Perry. Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts has filed its first round of signatures in the Ohio Attorney General's office to hold a referendum on the law that bails out nukes while scrapping green energy policy. In Colorado, more than 60 boxes of documents from the Rocky Flats grand jury probe have gone missing. Oops! The documents being sought were subpoenaed by a grand jury that met from 1989 to 1992 to look into environmental crimes committed at Rocky Flats, a former nuclear weapons plant that environmental groups contend left behind widespread contamination. That's not simply putting it in the wrong place. You'd need a semi to get that many boxes of documents out. That's nuclear, all right. When in doubt, destroy the evidence. And now...
Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nuclear hot seat. Nut nuts of the week.
Shame on National Geographic. On July 30th, they published an article with the unequivocal title... All spent nuclear fuel in the U.S. will soon end up in one place, meaning in New Mexico at the Eddie Lee site being promoted by Holtec International. The title presumes and promotes a done deal, but that is not the case. The site is publicly opposed by New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, Congresswoman Deb Haaland, and State Land Commissioner Stephanie Garcia Richard. There are the unmitigated dangers of having such a site in proximity with fracking and oil pipelines, to say nothing of the dangers of hauling that stuff from nuclear reactors around the country to New Mexico, something that is opposed by a group that says it plainly, haul no. How dare National Geographic come up with a done deal headline like that, which of course is then available to be Googled and searched and blah-de-de-blah. National Geographic, you are definitely this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
In the Marshall Islands, a new study by Columbia University shows that after 67 U.S. nuclear tests between 1946 and 1958, nuclear isotopes are still up to 1,000 times higher than Chernobyl or Fukushima. In Japan, word that 17 years is estimated to be needed to send treated Fukushima water into the Pacific Ocean. A good article in The Nation. Is Fukushima safe for the Olympics? Short answer, no. We'll link to it on the website. And in both France and Germany, hot weather, low river levels, and hot water in the rivers have forced the shutdown of four separate nuclear reactors. So when pro-nukesters say, well, with solar, the sun doesn't always shine, and with wind, it doesn't always blow, just put them back in their own hot water. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, the pro-nuclear propaganda keeps coming thick and fast, setting up talking points that the casual reader or legislator will catch in headlines and absorb as gospel truth, when it's really just the opposite. What is there to counter the lies of the nuclear industry? All the money and influence and smug, smarmy talking points. You know, I'm fond of saying that in the Battle of David and Goliath, David won. But sometimes this battle feels impossible. And yet, you, all of us, have persisted. For going on 9 years, Nuclear Hot Seat has been one of the only places where you can get a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information every week. Interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news, all sourced from reliable places, and there's never enough time for all the stories that deserve it, but still, I include numbnuts, bad puns, sometimes a touch of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry lies? Of course, this show has been operating for years on a budget that is less than what one nuclear lobbyist pays for one dinner with powerful legislators. And that budget is dependent on you, the listeners, to keep us going. So if you're against nukes and want to help get the word out, the way you can do it is with a donation. It's easy to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send a one-time donation or set up a monthly donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a good tip here in the U.S., just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please, do what you can now, and know that whatever you do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. Recently, a series of three articles appeared in the National Catholic Reporter about the Kansas City plant, known to the locals as KCP. The site manufactured 85% of the non-nuclear material used in the United States nuclear weapons arsenal and was known as a non-nuclear site. But how non-nuclear was it, really? That's what today's guest spent more than a year researching and writing. Claire Schaefer Duffy is a freelance journalist and worker in the Catholic peace movement. The three articles she wrote under the title Enemy Within paint an all-too-familiar picture of an unknown nuclear site poisoning land, water, and people for decades, with the government still trying to duck responsibility for what it did to those who worked and lived there. I spoke with Claire Schaefer Duffy on Thursday, August 1st, 2019.
Claire Schaefer Duffy, thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
Let's start out with a little bit about you. What is your background?
I am a woman of many hats. I am a member of the Catholic worker movement. This is a lay movement. I live and work at a Catholic worker house where we offer hospitality to homeless men and women and publish a newsletter called The Catholic Radical. I come from an activist background, peace activism. I'm also a freelance journalist contributing occasionally, primarily to the National Catholic Reporter. And then I do a small side gig on peace education with the Center for Nonviolent Solutions.
How did you come to write this series of articles on the Kansas City plant?
I wrote a review for America Magazine of Dan Zak's book on our nuclear culture, and I think it's called The Almighty. And he looks specifically at a disarmament action that happened at the Y-12 plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. But the book is very, very well written. And although it focuses on these four activists, it looks at the history of bomb making and also included a chapter on the health effects for a three-generation family of security workers in Rocky Flats and just the very severe health effects that they had from being there. And I was really kind of shocked. I was quite familiar that in the 50s, when the initial bomb tests were being done, that there wasn't knowledge about how drastic exposure, you know, open exposure to bomb tests can be for people. But this was more in the 80s. And so I had a question mark in my head, like, huh, I've never thought about that aspect of nuclear weapons, because in the 80s I had been involved in demonstrations against nuclear weapons and had some sense of the military-industrial complex from an activist perspective, but I hadn't thought about this domestic consequence that, you know, you always think about what will the bombs do when they're dropped on people elsewhere. And then I was actually at a contemplative retreat in Albuquerque. Prior to going there, I had read a report. I was at the UN doing interviews with nuns who were working on the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. This was back in July of 2017. So the conference at the UN was to do the final draft of this treaty. And in some of the online reports that were being put out by the International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons, there was a report about health effects on nuclear workers, a reference. It had many other details. And that reminded me of Dan Zak's book and my curiosity. So when I got to Albuquerque, I reached out to Terry Berry, who is with an organization that advocates for nuclear workers. Her husband was sickened, I think, from his work in Hanford. And she put the word out, and my phone just started pinging from Kansas City, all these people in Kansas City who wanted to talk. And I had to go through Kansas City on my way home. So I stopped on my way back East Coast, because I live in Massachusetts, and interviewed a number of people while I was in Kansas City, former workers. And I should say that the newspaper that published the article, the National Catholic Reporter, had done some reporting on a local protest around the old Kansas City plant closing and the city facilitating relocating elsewhere in Kansas City. So the newspaper had reported from that lens before.
Let's take a look at the Kansas City plant on Bannister Road in Kansas City. What was it and what is its current status?
Well, it's been shuttered now for 5 years. So the plant dates back, like a lot of our Cold War nuclear weapons facilities, to World War II. It was constructed very rapidly for the manufacturing of, I believe, fighter jet engines. So it was built in 1942. And after the war concluded, and this happened in many parts of the country, I think your listeners will probably be aware that the military-industrial complex really got started with that war, with World War II. And very, very, very rapid bomb manufacturing, weapon manufacturing facilities that were constructed. So this was one of them, and it employed a lot of people during the war. And then the war ended, and when the plant was constructed during World War II in 1942, they made this enormous manufacturing space, over 2.7 million square feet. So really huge sort of single building facility to work on these jet engines. And after the war concluded, there was a partial rental for engine construction. And then what was then the Atomic Energy Commission became interested in the property in 1949 when they were developing the nuclear arms industry and looking for locales to do that. the Department of Energy owned the property, but then they contract out to different companies, all right, we need you to build this. So Bendix was the first, then they morphed into becoming, I believe, Alliant, and then that became Honeywell, and Honeywell became the manager in the late 1990s. It was co-leased by the Government Service Administration, and it makes it very confusing to track the story.
The Kansas City plant manufactured electrical components for nuclear bombs, and for 60 years it produced 85% of the non-nuclear components for the country's nuclear arsenal. It was publicly known as a non-nuclear work site, but was that simply the truth when it first started operations, or was there a cover-up from the beginning? Because we now know that there were radioactive materials used on site.
Well, this is a complex question, and it's a question that I was trying to explore and found very challenging, because basically you're looking at a 60-year history. I think it is accurate, or at least the research that I was able to do, it is accurate that it was primarily a non-nuclear site. That does not mean that radioactive material was not on the property. You know, the public hears the term non-nuclear electrical components and you assume, you know, a relatively safe environment, although there were industrial waste there. But there was radioactive material used on the property, and this is what has been publicly disclosed. Dating back in the 50s, the plant was machining natural uranium slugs. Now, that's a lower level of radioactive uranium, but they were doing that. Then they worked with depleted uranium for at least 15 years, late 50s to the 70s. They also had magnesium thorium, which is a radioactive material used. And what made it challenging to determine the plant's manufacturing history is that there are some assignments that remained classified, and workers were obligated not to divulge, you know, what they did, because this is a weapons plant. So this complicates full knowledge of the plant's manufacturing history. Also, the multiple contractors complicates that. I did speak with one analyst who referenced, you know, in the 60s, there was a very high volume of nuclear weapons productions and going on up until the 70s. So there could have been some assignments passed on to this non-nuclear plant. But documentation of what radioactive material was used was revealed over a long period of time. It took time to figure that out and for the government to disclose all of the assignments that had happened over the 60-year period.
In your article, you had a quote from Bob Alvarez, who is senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and has regularly been a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat. He's quoted as saying, "In order to make the most dangerous weapons in the world, workers had to handle the most dangerous material in the world. And a lot of that dangerous material is still lying around posing risks to people." What do you know that the workers were told about their exposure to the radioactive and other toxic materials at the site and the possible negative health effects?
A couple of workers that I interviewed who had been at the plant over several decades reported that there was little to very poor training dealing with beryllium, which is not a radioactive material. It's a metal that's used in a lot in the nuclear weapons industry because it's got a lot of characteristics that are beneficial for making weapons, including durability. But if you machine it, if you inhale the beryllium dust, it can be very carcinogenic. It can cause serious lung damage that's not immediately evident. So there was, under the Bendix period, time period of the plant, I think the industrial hygiene around beryllium was very poor. one worker who did not want to divulge his name, whose wife had died from leukemia and had only worked briefly at the plant, and she moved in multiple departments. She moved around in different departments. He thought that there was not at all enough training notification. Others reported that during the Honeywell period and later years, they improved in providing protective clothing. There was a clinic on the plant that was reportedly checking people's lungs, you know, periodically. The workers that were in areas that had radioactive material or risk of being exposed to radioactive material had dosimeters, which are supposed to give you some indicator, you know, if you've been exposed. But it's very difficult, according to one industrial hygienist, to really be able to do this in a way that is safe for multiple reasons. One, that in the rush of production, priority is given to production over worker safety and health. How to read the dosimeters and what you're recording, there's debate, and it's not as hard data as one would hope it could be. Third, human bodies are very diverse, and so influence depends also on one's body composition. And your listeners probably know that radiation exposure has a very different effect on the female body than the male. The consequences are distinct, and even the labor OSHA requirements. OSHA tries to standardize and say this is how much you can expose, you know, a person before it becomes hazardous to their health. But the person in that equation is a 40-year-old male. Now, OSHA standards are not what are used in the nuclear weapons industry today. They have their own standards, which I think might even be a little bit more vigorous. But I think that was one of my big takeaways, is realizing even with efforts to track the health hazards of these materials, there's still just a lot of unknowns and also a lot of variables, because you're talking about industrial work sites where there's just tremendous movement of machines, of people. It's not a static environment. It's not a controlled lab where you're sealing everything off all the time.
How did the story start to emerge that this purportedly non-nuclear site was not as non-nuclear as the government stated?
I was very influenced, or grateful, I should say, for the reporting of Russ Potasik, who was between the fall of 2009 and early 2012. He was a television investigative journalist for a Kansas City station. And he was trying to just figure out what was making the people at the plant, because the plant had employees reporting that they were sick. And so he was trying to figure out what were the toxins. So his reporting located some radioactive exposure. There was a promethium spill at the plant that was detected several years out. But it looked a lot at beryllium exposure. And to be fair to the DOE, Department of Energy, which owned the property, when they're saying non-nuclear, it is accurate relative to the spectrum of nuclear material used in this industry. That KCP was not, for example, like the former Hanford plant in Washington State. It wasn't a place where they were manufacturing plutonium. It wasn't like Pantech in Texas, where they're doing assembly of nuclear weapons and are unequivocally exposed to radioactive materials. So it's important to say, you know, that it was predominantly a non-nuclear plant. However, there were radioactive materials used there, and there were a number of industrial toxins, ultimately over 2,000 that were identified. And some of that had dated back, because the facility had been a storage site for weapons waste. And there were classified trenches that had been on the property that were excavated and moved. But this material is not static. I think I used the metaphor. This is not like scrubbing the dirt in your kitchen floor where you just wipe it up and it's gone.
In 2009, an unusual document surfaced. It was a death list, quote-unquote, of nearly 200 former employees who claimed they became gravely ill after working at the Kansas City plant. Where did that list come from, and what kind of impact did it have?
Well, that is what triggered Potashik's investigation. So the origin, as I reported it, there was a former employee. She was working at the Marine Data Finance Center. Her name was Barbara Rice. So again, to remind people of the history of this property, you had on one half or in some of the buildings, the Kansas City plant where they were manufacturing electrical components for nuclear bombs, and I believe also doing some low-level research or lab work. And then adjacent, you had a number of federal offices. So the IRS had some offices there, the Marine Data Financing Center had offices there, because half of the property was owned by what's called the Government Service Administration. Those would be people doing completely non-weapon related work. So what Barbara Rice was working in, an office that shared a common wall with the Kansas City plant. So this enormous manufacturing space was partially occupied by manufacturing workshops, you know, for the weapons production, and then part of it cordoned off into offices. So they had this common wall. But she had retired and was just, like many of us, you know, trying to locate some of her old friends from her days working out what people used to call the Bendit plant, and noticed that a number of them had died, and died in their 60s. And so, you know, she's a data person, and so she found that kind of surprising, and she began to reach out and start making her own Excel spreadsheet just based on Facebook, you know, what happened to so-and-so, what happened to so-and-so. And people saying, oh, well, you know, they died of this. So I think she had, I don't know what the initial number, but she did show the Government Service Administration because she thought it showed high rates of grave illness or early death among employees, most of them working not in the Kansas City plant, but in the Government Service Administration offices. And the list, as she reported to me, was higher ups that she showed initially ignored it, and then her son showed it to this investigative journalist, and he became very curious. And the television station created their own database and asked people who worked at either the Government Service Administration offices or Kansas City plant former employees, if you know people who have died, if you're suffering from illnesses, you can self-report. So it should be clearly stated that this was self-reporting, you know, people saying, oh, I had cancer, or so-and-so had sarcoidosis, which is what you'd get from beryllium exposure. So that list, over the course of the year, went up to 500, nearly 500 people, 464, the version that I saw. And there were a lot of cancers, a lot of cancers, cancers of not just lung, but brain and different organs, and also a lot of respiratory illnesses.
Do we have any idea how many Americans died producing nuclear weapons?
Don't. At least I should say I don't have a hard figure. There was a very influential and strongly researched series by McClatchy called Irradiated that came out in 2015. They spent a year working on that, and the figure that they came up with was over 34,000. And the Columbia Journalism Review questioned that total, said it's 34,000 that the government, the U.S. government, acknowledges that 15,000 of that 34,000 died from worksite exposure. The others, they could have died from old age, other complicating factors. And this is something that, also to be fair, the effect of carcinogenic material or even industrial toxins, it's not like getting shot by a bullet, right? You don't just breathe it one day and then drop dead. It's often latent, and it can manifest down the road, many years down the road. So it is hard to completely, unequivocally say, this is because I worked for 20 years in your plant. However, if you look at the number of the ailments described on even the database that was produced by the television station in Kansas City, it's a high number of people dying, what I would describe as possibly early premature deaths from very significant ailments that do seem related to industrial exposure. So I think we need a lot more research. And I was surprised, really surprised, that there wasn't more research done on exposure. There's unequivocal agreement that exposure to radioactive material is carcinogenic and causes cancer. The nuclear weapons industry knew that back in the 50s. And they had scientists saying, you know, this is highly hazardous work. And some felt ethically compelled to say, you should let workers know this is highly hazardous. But that was not revealed to workers for decades later.
The site of the Kansas City plant from World War II, you said, has been shut down for about 5 years. And various of the manufacturing processes have been shipped to another facility 8 miles away. What are the current plans for the old site, given the fact that it is known to be contaminated with all kinds of industrial and radioactive waste?
It's under demolition and remediation. In fact, I think the demolition is almost entirely done, or if not nearly done. An individual developer purchased the property and has plans to make an industrial business park. It cannot be used for residential purposes, but I think they're hoping to make it a site for distribution and some manufacturing. So that is already underway. That's happening in many former Cold War plants around the country that are being repurposed. And I think when we ask ourselves as a people, how much of an investment are we being asked to give to this industry, we need to think about its legacy, because some of these properties, they just have to be monitored on into the future forever, because radioactive material, once it becomes airborne, you know, you're just constantly checking to see if it's in your environment. But at the same time, you have these large areas, 300-acre lots, 200-acre lots that were very significant employers for local communities. So what are you going to do with them? And there is an effort to repurpose them for either manufacturing or business parks or
wildlife refuges.
Yes, or wildlife refuge, yes, exactly, which is what was done to Rocky Flats. But on one hand, certainly that is better than, as one Kansas City councilman told me, he said, I was very happy that a private developer wanted to take on this property, because if it just sits there as a abandoned brownfield, it's far more hazardous. We're not going to have the remediation and cleanup effort that, as he put it, he said, it's a ticking time bomb, because the old plant was in a floodplain, which is very worrisome, especially given climate change. And this is a factor with the Savannah River plant. It's in an area where if you have natural disasters, you have contaminants released, you know, dispersed because of flooding. So he was happy that this developer wanted to try to come in and remediate, or what they had to do is remove a lot of the soil, and it's taken down to these waste disposal places in Texas. The amount of radioactive material that came from the KCP transported to Utah, I talked to the waste management disposal people there that received the KCP nuclear waste, and they said the building debris was very small from their perspective. They are accustomed to getting much, much higher volumes of contaminated building debris, but what came from the KCP, they said, was very, very small.
Given that the current administration is adamant about modernization of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, meaning building new weapons, while weakening environmental regulations and federal laws protecting worker safety, do you see that we have any way out of the mess that not only has been created, but may continue to be created?
I think there has to be the one hope, and this was the impetus for writing the article, is extreme vigilance on the part of local communities and asking a lot of questions about any nuclear weapons production that is going on in one's area, because it is a very potentially hazardous industry that is not contained. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the story in Ohio, but they had to shut down the middle school because in the process of trying to clean up a facility that was 4 miles away, they were detecting radioactive readings in the school. So I think there has to be a lot of citizen or local education. And this is a challenging task because we don't have a robust EPA. The state, in the case of the KCP, the gatekeepers, so to speak, for the community to some extent are the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. But they are limited in their funds and capacities. And at the old plant, they're monitoring, because the old plant had 42 hazardous waste management areas. And some of them have been completely closed and are no longer considered a source of concern. But others have to be monitored in perpetuity, as does the water supply. So I think a lot of local education, extreme vigilance, offering support and funding for environmental groups that are trying to monitor, because this is extremely important. Water supplies and your ground soil, you know, they move. We're talking about an industry whose effect, and that's true for, it's not confined to the nuclear weapons industry. And a lot of industrial waste can move, but this has maybe even more volatility. And its quantity is just a small amount of radioactive material can cause problems.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that you haven't had a chance to say yet?
My hope is that when we think about nuclear weapons, the common assumption is these are essential for our security. I, as an individual, don't agree with that. But if one does agree with that, then you have to ask, how much is that security worth? And are you willing to offer the lives of the employees that make them? Because this is a weapon that, even without being used, or causing detonations and explosions in distant lands, is destructive because of what it's composed of and because of the process of making it. And is that really security? If in the process, you know, you have people dying in the manufacturing, and do we want to offer ourselves to that kind of security? That's my question. My hope is that we will see that it's not worth it. It's not worth it, and we have to find other methods of security, because we're deceiving ourselves to say that we're protecting our lives at the expense of some people getting early dementia, you know, brain cancer, their reproductive health compromised, their children potentially compromised, our water supplies compromised. This is not security. This is living in a contaminated world that is very worrisome.
That was journalist Claire Schaefer Duffy. We will, of course, link to her three Enemy Within articles on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 424. Some of the individuals and stories that Claire referred to have been covered on Nuclear Hot Seat in depth. Mary Olson's work on gender and radiation, which was used at the United Nations to help gain passage of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Then 82-year-old sister Megan Rice's break-in with two other Plowshares peace activists to the Y-12 site in Kentucky, the Fort Knox of nuclear sites. We spoke with Megan in an extended interview only 2 weeks after her release from prison. And Terry Berry, founder of the Alliance of Nuclear Workers Advocacy Groups, who has been advocating for nuclear workers for years. We will have links up also to the episodes featuring interviews with each of them. Again, you will find it at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 424. Activist shout out! Physicians for Social Responsibility is hosting the Visionary Leaders Awards Reception and Symposium on Thursday, November 7, 2019, in Washington, D.C. Now in its fourth year, the Visionary Leaders Awards recognizes individuals and/or organizations for their exemplary efforts in advancing nuclear weapons abolition and/or addressing environmental risks to human health. Honorees this year include Mary Leah Kelly, co-founder and executive director of Tri-Valley Cares, which stands for Communities Against a Radioactive Environment. That's the group that stages the protest in front of the Lawrence Livermore Labs here in California, and also has been very active in the fight to shut down the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors. Other honorees include Kelly Campbell and Regna Merritt, chapter leaders of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led nonprofit pushing immediate political action on climate change. Very specially, Dr. Helen Caldicott will be presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award for her internationally renowned work to educate the public about the health hazards of nuclear war. Dr. Caldicott served as the president of PSR from 1977 to 1986 and helped revive the organization. Well done, all. Wish I could be there. I'll be cheering you on from a distance. The Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space is calling for a body of legal experts who wish to explore the fact that international space law is a subject presently thoroughly dominated by leaders of the aerospace industry who are more than eager to privatize space to the benefit of corporate sponsors and wealthy individuals. Global Network, which is more easily remembered online as spaceforpeace.blogspot.com, with that four being a number, is co-sponsoring a conference at Visakhapatnam, India, on October 12 and 13, 2019, at the Damodaram Sanjivaya National Law University, and a commemoration of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki will take place in Los Angeles on Thursday, August 8, from 6:30 to 7:30 at Toriumi Plaza in Little Tokyo, the northwest corner of East First Street and San Pedro Street. I will be there, and if you can manage to make it, I look forward to meeting you at that time. And if you can find a commemoration near you, please attend. If you can't, at least light a candle in commemoration of all the nuclear dead. Here's today's final thought. As I shared at the top of the program today, August 6 marks the 74th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, followed on August 9 by the dropping of a second bomb on Nagasaki. The world stood aghast at the devastation caused, in each instance, by a single weapon. There was condemnation of the United States for having gone after a civilian population not once, but twice. Yet any ongoing condemnation of our country quickly dropped away, and even the most skeptical among U.S. citizens soon fell under the sway of this deadly new technology. How did that happen? Well, I lay it squarely at the feet of one man, William Lawrence, the first science editor of the New York Times, whose words were used to con the world. Now, what follows comes from the excellent book News Zero, The New York Times and the Bomb by Beverly Ann Deep Keever. And, of course, we will link to that on our website. Here's the short version. When the Trinity bomb test was planned for the New Mexico desert near Alamogordo, the military knew it had to have a good cover story for such a large explosion in the middle of the desert. Lieutenant General Leslie Richard Groves, Jr., who directed the Manhattan Project, brought in Lawrence to write not one but four press releases that could cover any eventuality following the test and disguise both the detonation and any resulting radiation. Lawrence did as instructed, his four press releases covering the spectrum of eventualities that ranged from a loud explosion without property damage or loss of life to worst-case scenario of a mammoth explosion causing widespread destruction of property and loss of life. Groves and indeed Lawrence knew about the dangers of radiation, but intentionally did not address it in the press releases. The Army knew they had a good thing and kept Lawrence on nuclear detail after this first set of press releases. He was supposed to fly in a follow-up plane to Hiroshima, but a last-minute mechanical problem scratched his flight. He did, however, fly follow-up to Nagasaki and watch the detonation that killed 75,000 people in a single flash. Then, under instructions from the Army, though still listed as a reporter for the New York Times, Lawrence wrote a 10-part series on the birth of the A-bomb and the wonders of its technology. A skilled writer, he skirted the dangers of exposure to radioactivity, either not mentioning its existence or limiting it to minor factoids with no context. Now remember, at this time, no one knew anything about atomic anything, let alone radiation's deadly legacy. The baseline of our national and even international understanding was created by Lawrence for the Army and published by the New York Times. And then the Times, under the directive of the Army, magnanimously offered the 10-part series to any paper that wanted it for free. It also published the articles together in a pamphlet for use in schools. So under the guise of reporting just the facts, ma'am, atomic bills, soft peddling, and avoidance of any honest information about the radiation dangers of nuclear became the baseline understanding of atomic everything for the world. And that's why within 1 year, public resistance to atomic atmospheric testing vanished, and we started exploding A-bombs all over the place, with 100 atmospheric tests in Nevada alone, and most horrifically, 67 detonations in the Marshall Islands, where we committed radioactive racism on a peaceful native people, something for which this country still refuses to take full responsibility today. Public relations is defined by its creator, Edward Bernays, as the manipulation of consent. Propaganda takes it a step further, manipulating consent by the intentional twisting of information in order to better its own cause, often with little regard for accuracy. William Lawrence, purportedly a journalist, became a nuclear propagandist, the first, and provided the basis for all the public's subsequent misunderstandings about nuclear dangers. Only one reporter, Wilfred Bruchette, ever got the story around the U.S. censors and got it right, publishing in the London Daily Express about radiation dangers and deaths in Hiroshima. His story was headlined "The Atomic Plague," and it was swiftly buried. It's Lawrence and his perspective that prevailed. Lawrence is a major part of why we do not fear the emissions from nuclear power reactors, why liars tell us with a straight face that fear of radiation is worse for our health than exposure to it, why some in power today insist that a nuclear war is winnable, and we just need smaller, cuter nukes to use on all those pesky little Middle Eastern countries that, by the way, just happen to contain oil. To this day, our government and pro-nukers across the world lie, minimize, and dismiss concerns about radiation. And they continue to get away with it because genuine experts who speak the truth about the dangers are marginalized, contradicted, trolled, underfunded, or simply ignored because, according to the pro-nukers, hey, they know the truth about nuclear. Don't go messing it up with any facts. On this anniversary of the two worst uses of weapons of mass destruction in the history of the planet, let us pause to commemorate those who died and then dedicate ourselves once again to sharing the nuclear truths, no matter how hard, how discounted, contradicted, dismissed, repressed, or censored by nuclear propagandists protecting their money and their power. We must continue to make our voices heard, because those who perished at Hiroshima and Nagasaki deserve nothing less. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 6, 2019. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, miningawareness.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, National Geographic, stuartsmith.com, dispatch.com, fox2news.com, radio.wosu.org, thenews-messenger.com, Denver Post, yahoo.com, Tri-CityHerald.com, GreenvilleOnline.com, EastIdahoNews.com, IdahoNews.com, JapanTimes.co.jp, Reuters.com, NewScientist.com, AvalNews.com, News.com.au, MarianneWildArt.wordpress.com, the Slow Motion Murderers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the brain-dead cubicle drones who write press releases for World Nuclear News. Thanks to all of you for listening, with a big shout-out to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world, in 123 countries on 6 continents and counting. If you haven't already done so, go to our Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook page, like it, share it, respond to a post. Let's get a dialogue going. If you would like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week and never miss an episode, it's easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. Scroll down to the yellow opt-in box and sign up for a weekly email link to the latest show. If you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. We will really appreciate your support. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that, as Hiroshima survivor Seth Scothurlo said upon accepting the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, the nuclear arsenal represents a self-destruct button for the human race. There you go. If that's not a nuclear wake-up call, I do not know what is. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.